I think we're going live. Hi, everyone. It's Margie McHugh from NPI's National Center on Immigrant Integration Policy. Thanks so much for taking the time to join us for this webinar that is related to the release of a new report today called Unlocking Skills, Successful Initiatives for Integrating Foreign-Trained Immigrant Professionals. And we are really pleased that we are, logistics first. Up on your screen there, you'll see that you can find slides and audio from today's webinar there at that link on our website. You see the bit.ly for the report. If you have any problems hearing us or with any of the technology around the webinar, please email us at that events@migrationpolicy.org email or call at that number that you see on the screen, 266-1929. And throughout the webinar, it's great if we get your questions as you think of them, because that lets us sort of distribute the questions among the speakers and the like. So please feel free to either use the Q&A chat function on the right of the screen, send your questions to moderator. That'll come to us here at NPI, the folks who are working on the webinar. And you can also tweet your questions. You see there the hashtag. And also, again, you can use that events@migrationpolicy.org email for questions as well. So we are really, really pleased today that in addition to Madeline Morosky and I, who are the report authors from NPI, that Karen Phillippe, who's the Deputy Director of the Michigan Office of New Americans, has joined us, and you'll be hearing from her after we talk a little bit about the report, about some of the SMART initiatives that that she's been leading there in Michigan, trying to address a number of the concerns that you'll hear about throughout the webinar, and also some of the work of her office is talked about in the report. So I'll just say briefly, I think most of you who are on the call are already pretty familiar with the breadth of our work here at the National Center on Immigrant Integration Policy. We spend a lot of time in the set of education pipeline issues, going from early childhood up through adult education and workforce training, just because of how critical those systems are to helping immigrants and their children successfully integrate into the mainstream of U.S. society. We also have a big focus on language access and other benefit programs, and then also on the governance of integration policy. So this set of issues related to folks who are highly educated, who come from abroad and aren't able to use their skills in the U.S. Workforce or have them be recognized fits very much in the set of issues that that we really try to help both states and localities and also federal agencies make progress on. So in terms of today's report and how we're going to walk through basically the some of the key aspects of the report, we follow pretty much the way it's organized in the actual publication. I'll talk a little bit about barriers, the key barriers to having foreign qualifications recognized. Madeline will speak in more detail about successful program designs to address them. The report has a fair amount about state and federal policy opportunities. We'll sort of scrunch that down into talking about recommendations to advance the field. Basically, the report, we tried to thread in a lot of examples from exceptional programs. Nearly all of them are finalists for the prizes program that NPI ran for about 5 years, the Pluribus Unum Prizes Program, that identified exceptional integration initiatives across the country. And basically, the report dials forward from what we kind of knew about a lot of the programs that we encountered through that prize program to look at their work in the context of larger policy dynamics and funding dynamics that the field has been facing. So pretty quickly, you can find out a lot more about these in the report itself. But one of the key barriers that so many folks in the field are working on is the issue of helping foreign-trained immigrants and refugees meet licensing requirements for the various professions that they've been trained in. It might be an understatement in many cases to say that those licensing requirements can be complex and bureaucratic. And part of the difficulty is that they're set at the state level. They're often set by professional associations, and even though, of course, these licensing requirements are meant to protect consumers and assure public health and safety, and really do most of the time serve important public policy goals, very often they can be unnecessary and/or extremely or unduly burdensome. And so this is an issue that many of you are up against who are trying to work to support foreign-trained professionals in making their way into jobs that will fully utilize their skills. Another major area of challenges and barriers that we discuss in the report is the difficulty that immigrants and refugees may face in filling gaps in their underlying education and training. Many of you know the examples of how long it can take for folks to try and become relicensed or to try and obtain training that they may need, particularly clinical training. It's often very difficult if a person is missing only one or two courses in a particular degree to be able to get those standalone courses to fill those gaps. And of course, given the importance of hands-on training in many professions, often if you're not part of a program here in the U.S. where you've already gotten your education through that program, you often can't get into then the supervised training that's a central component of becoming licensed or certified in a field. We also go into a fair amount of discussion in the report about the challenges that individuals face in building professional level English skills, given that so many adult English programs are focused on helping folks who often are at lower levels of English proficiency and/or that the programs don't focus on the type of language that would be most useful in terms of trying to gain the technical English that's needed for specific occupations or the advanced English that's needed to pass licensing exams. So you'll hear a lot of that discussion as we go on. Then also a number of the terrific groups that whose work we explore in the report have spent a lot of time thinking about how to help foreign-trained professionals develop the soft skills, the social capital that they need in order to be able to find the right match with jobs and succeed in them, and also that even when all of this work is done to help folks fill gaps, get the English they need, network to find jobs that suit them, then that there's also the issue of employer bias, either with employers not recognizing or understanding how to recognize the credentials that they have, or just outright discriminating against individuals that are from other countries that may speak with an accent, et cetera, et cetera. So we'll talk a lot about the types of programs that help develop these job search skills, professional networks, and the like, both during this webinar and you'll find it in the report. So that's not an exhaustive list of all of the challenges and the like that are discussed in the report, but those are the top line ones. And now I will turn it over to Madeline Morosky, co-author of the report. She's an associate policy analyst here at MPI and has actually been part for several years now of some of the key publications and work of the center in trying to track important issues in this space, and brought a lot of terrific experience to the research related to this report. She'll be talking, as I said earlier, about a lot of the solutions to these various challenges that I just described. Madeline?
Thanks, Margie. So I'm going to start by walking through some of the solutions we identified in the report and then giving you a few examples of the successful programs that we identified and how they've done a good job at helping these foreign-trained immigrants transition into skilled work. So the first solution is simply providing information. It seems simple, but it's one of the first barriers that folks encounter because often the licensing rules are set state by state and occupation by occupation, and they may vary in terms of the quality and breadth of information available online. So it's important that organizations providing this information can really have the expertise to guide folks. So a great example of this is Upwardly Global. They've developed more than a dozen licensing guides specific to 5 states in a number of occupations, including some healthcare occupations, as well as for engineering and teaching. And the strength of these guides is that they really articulate the challenges that immigrants in particular might face as they're going through relicensure. Michigan, Karen will talk a little bit about this, has also a very extensive set of licensing guides. So the next solution is career guidance and navigation. Because the challenges people face are so unique to their own situation, they often vary based on how long they've been in the United States, what their education and training was like before they got here, if they've maybe been in a refugee camp and have been out of the workforce for many years. Each person requires individualized guidance, so having a career counselor or navigator is a really important aspect to this program. Case management is also important because of how lengthy the relicensing process can be. So initiatives like the Welcome Back Initiative have a really great model for helping folks identify their own personal goals, decide whether or not they want to relicense, and come up with alternatives to that if that's what they prefer. And then another great example is the Colorado Welcome Back Center. They work a lot with doctors who have one of the most lengthy and arduous relicensing processes. So that's an instance where a career navigator is really important to keep people motivated and address obstacles that arise. So filling gaps in education and training, as Margie mentioned, is also incredibly challenging. A great way to help immigrants do this is through refresher courses that may offer just one course in a particular area that they lack. We've heard nurses sometimes lack pediatric nursing courses maybe a specialized technology that someone needs to learn how to use. Exam prep. Even if someone's been practicing for many years, they may not be prepared to take an exam. So help studying for that is important. And supervised training, as Margie mentioned, can be quite challenging. So internships, apprenticeships can be very useful. A great example of refresher courses is the Cooper Union's Immigrant Engineer Retraining Program. They offer standalone courses to help people get their skills up to date. And the Welcome Back Center of Suburban Maryland has a program where they help foreign nurses get into nurse-in-training positions so they can gain supervised experience and also earn wages. So for professional-level English, contextualized English is a great solution. It allows people to develop specialized vocabulary in English that's adapted to the specific settings they might need it in. So you would have an ESL course where you practice your English skills as if you were at work. Training for the tests that are required to either demonstrate your English proficiency on a licensing exam for the TOEFL is an example of a academic test that is often required along with a licensing application. So specific preparation for those tests can often be very important because they may test academic English that isn't a great fit even for someone who is quite proficient. A good example of these types of programs are the Welcoming Center for New Pennsylvanians, who have professional level English courses that go beyond what you might get through the general federally funded ESL, and that includes a very popular professional writing course, which is a great resource for people who are going to be working in an environment where they have to write at a high level. soft skills and employer bias are also important challenges to address, as Margie noted. Job application workshops that teach people what's expected on U.S. resumes, how to conduct yourself in an interview, where to look for jobs, can all be really important. Upwardly Global has a great system. It's called their Job Seeker Training Program. They do mock interviews that allow people to improve their interviewing skills, and they also bring in community members and other professionals for networking events, which helps foreign-trained immigrants develop their professional networks, which is often something they lack when they arrive in the United States. Employer partnerships can help overcome some of the employer bias issues by allowing professionals to become more acquainted with the types of challenges that foreign-trained immigrants face and perhaps be more open to making an effort to understand their qualifications when they come in for job interviews. Upwardly Global has some partnerships with employers that allow the employees to come in and work with Upwardly Global clients as volunteers, which is a great way to gain familiarity with foreign-trained immigrants and learn about the skills and qualifications they might bring to a job. So addressing policy barriers was the final type of solution we looked at. It's often the hardest solution because of the systemic challenges, some of which Margie mentioned. So the first step is often just to educate policymakers and the licensing bodies about the fact that there are foreign-trained immigrants and that they face all these challenges. And then the next step is often to review licensing regulations to see where they may be unnecessary or where alternatives could be put in place. And then finally, when there are unnecessary requirements, targeting those specifically and seeing where they could be eliminated or where alternatives could be used. A great example are some task forces that were developed in Massachusetts and Minnesota. The Massachusetts task force focused on immigrants in the healthcare profession, and the Minnesota task force focuses specifically on foreign-trained physicians. Those task forces looked at the state's licensing rules and identified some recommendations of how they could be changed to help foreign-trained immigrants enter the workforce, and also develop roadmaps to how those goals could be accomplished. On a smaller scale, the Puget Sound Welcome Back Center developed a relationship with the nursing board in Washington State, and they were able to advocate for a specific type of English proficiency test that could be used as an alternative to the TOEFL that they felt measured the same skills and qualifications but was better suited to their clients and didn't have as many academic requirements. So despite all these great models, there are some ongoing challenges that have to be addressed in order to really address the problem of brain waste in a comprehensive way. The first challenge is that the licensing rules are difficult to reform. They are, as I think Margie mentioned earlier, they're set at the state level. Sometimes the licensing bodies are spread across multiple government agencies, and then there are also professional associations who may have their own interests, and they occasionally lobby against reducing certain licensing barriers. Effective programs have trouble achieving economies of scale because of the specialized nature of certain requirements. If you have an English course for pharmacists, you may have trouble getting enough students each semester to justify hiring a teacher. And career reentry services are not always a good fit for the existing funding models. As we've mentioned, it can take many years and individuals' goals may change over time in terms of what type of career they're looking to enter. So often the federally funded workforce programs expect employment outcomes within a year. Other funding models often also use standardized outcome measures that require progress within a year or less. Employer bias is also an area that there hasn't been a lot of progress in. There are some great models, as we've seen, from Upwardly Global to bring employers in and educate them, but on a systemic level, there have not been many initiatives to address this. And then efforts to enhance skill mobility and reciprocity are also limited. This could include mutual recognition agreements, which exist in Europe and Asia, to help individuals move between countries and get their skills and qualifications recognized. But this is especially difficult in the United States because of the state nature of the licensing requirements for many occupations. So with that, I'm going to turn it back over to Margie, who's going to walk through some of the recommendations.
Thanks, Madeline. So I would just say that those ongoing challenges that Madeline walked through, we did try to do sort of a deep think, try to look at the field, look at how things have advanced, really kind of scoop into the report what are some of the kind of leading edge initiatives that that maybe the field could take advantage of. And then in addition to the, you know, the how do we think about expanding services, you know, how do we also think about bigger wins in terms of trying to better align policies and then deal with some of these difficulties that that Madeline just spoke about in terms of the ongoing challenges. So you'll find a lot about licensing reform sort of sprinkled throughout the report, but we did think that there are, you know, there are some new things that are going on. So obviously, we think that some of the initiatives that have been undertaken to review or reform state licensing laws are things that that folks can think about at the state and local level about what would it look like to try and undertake that sort of a reform in your state, and how would you go about that. So, one of the things that that we certainly noticed is that that what has thwarted some of these efforts in the past is that there are a lot of competing agendas that very often folks who are working on this come up in particular against the interests of professional associations that that many states as a default allow to set their licensing standards. And that those can be pretty, it can be pretty hard to have enough power to really negotiate effectively with them. And so whatever is set up in terms of a process really needs to take account that that a number of really relevant players in this have competing agendas, and therefore you have to have enough enough political attention and a real referee in a sense. For how to negotiate amongst a lot of these issues and come up with solutions. We thought it was really promising, though, that there are other allies, or there appear to be other allies that are joining or are part of these issues. Some of you may be aware that there was a Department of Defense working group that actually First Lady Michelle Obama and also Jill Biden co-chaired, that started out as a look of about at what would help military families and spouses, and it turned into a very significant report that argued for the streamlining of credentialing and licensing measures that would specifically help with veterans reentering the workforce and also military spouses who very often have professional licenses and training that they have a really hard time getting recognized as they move from state to state. To accompany their active duty spouses. So we saw coming out of that, for example, an interesting report that came out of the Little Hoover Commission in California that stacked up the issues that were facing veterans and military spouses along with foreign-trained immigrant professionals and along with folks who are trying to reentering the workforce after having been incarcerated. So, you know, it's easy to see that that a number of real important stakeholders are taking a look at these issues, and that might add add value and add traction to trying to get state licensing laws reviewed. We also talk a little bit about how these broad-based efforts might be very attractive and could achieve much bigger gains, but they also are probably super complex to have happen and to make sure that all the moving parts actually move in some sort of a coordinated way. And so it's clear from the report that some of these single industry efforts, like the one, the task force that the Massachusetts Immigrant and Refugee Advocacy Coalition helped lead in their state, and then also the task force on foreign trained physicians that happened in Minnesota. You know, the Minnesota example is a fantastic one of how so many different so many of the different problems that were facing foreign trained physicians were pinpointed, and very specific and tailored solutions were designed. But anyway, we think, you know, I think overall, we think that this is one of the leading edges for the field to move forward now that there are a number of good examples to look at and new potential allies. We also think that the area of trying to just expand service programs more generally also has some new lift under it. Partly that's because of the passage of the Workforce Innovation and Opportunity Act, and the way that it now mandates that all Title II funded, all adult education, adult ESL programs that are funded under the system meet pretty strict employment, median earning, and credential and employer satisfaction measures. And so on the one hand, with our under the MPI umbrella and our center's umbrella more broadly, we're sort of afraid that that law and those performance requirements are going to drive services away from lower educated low LEP individuals. On the other hand, it really could help move services towards the highly trained immigrant professional population that needs the advanced English training and also some other bridge programming to support their topping off their skills. So we think that many of you have reported to us how difficult it is to overcome some of the sort of requirements, I guess, under existing program models and the way that programs are funded. It's very hard, as Madeline was referring to just enroll enough people from semester to semester in a high-level English class. And so it's really not a business model that can be sustained or a program model that can be sustained under traditional funding streams. And so we talk a bit in the report about technology-assisted programs. We're always impressed with the USA Learns operation that was started by the California Department of Education and is still being run out of the Sacramento Office of Adult Education. They recently created an advanced English program for certified nurse assistants. Obviously, a model like that could be expanded. And then also in the area of bridge programming more generally, and we use bridge here in the sense of how to help people bridge back into their careers, through the suite of services that that you see a number of the leading edge programs providing, that those sorts of programs could be expanded into additional fields. They're primarily available now for folks who are working in various healthcare professions, and we do think that given that under the refugee law, that the Office of Refugee Resettlement is specifically called out as a place that should be playing more of a role in helping individuals have their skills recertified, their education recertified here in the U.S., that to the extent that we need new models to be tested and developed, that some of that could happen in a more coordinated way through ORR. We also think that there's a, given that there might be, we expect that a number of new programs will be funded via the Workforce Innovation and Opportunity Act, that it mainly seems to us that they're getting funded outside of mainstream RFPs and the like, and that the big problem that systems face is that they don't know how to price what all of you who are doing these services are doing. They don't know how to judge what you're doing. And so it's not that they're they're completely unsympathetic. It's more that they don't have something to hang their hats on to say, yeah, we know that this is in a sense a qualified approach to doing this and that what you're looking to charge us for doing it is within the usual parameters. And so so we definitely think that that the field needs to figure out how to have more effective programs evaluated, have the various elements analyzed, and then also we need to understand more about what is allowing some adult ed and workforce training systems to actually fund some of the programs that are working with foreign trained professionals, because that would then also allow the field to give better advice, in a sense, state by state and locality by locality, about how to meet these needs. And so we talk in the report a bit about who could be doing some of that evaluation, and what are some of the main funding streams that could be looked at to try and have that evaluation done. Obviously, we're eager to be in touch with folks in the field about how to advance a recommendation like that, because some of it could happen at the federal level. We knew we wouldn't have enough time on the webinar to talk a lot about the employer discrimination issues, but suffice it to say there's a big discussion about that in the report. We talk about more that for those of you who are working with employers locally, just some of the things that they could do themselves in terms of increasing the training of all of their staff who are involved in hiring processes, and then maybe also working with some of the equal opportunity agencies that work inside of government, both to be thinking about testing for employer bias against foreign trained immigrants, and also doing more formal trainings for employer associations or employers around those sorts of issues. And then again, this is a big issue for those of you who follow MPI's work. We've been doing a lot of work internationally around reciprocity and mutual recognition agreements. And we just wanted to point out to the field via this report that that really is an issue that could be moving at the state level, since states are setting so many of the, are really in the driver's seat with overseeing these licensing systems. They actually could go kind of outside the box in terms of what they currently do, and even be thinking about setting up some of their own mutual recognition agreements for certain professions with systems that are outside the U.S. It just feels that that's an area where we could get, with a little bit of innovation, with a little bit of confidence and prodding, that we might be able to have states really see that they could solve some of their problems in shortage areas by really tackling these issues, by being more innovative around these issues. So with that, I would like to turn it over to Karen, as I said earlier, we're just delighted she could join us. We've been following the great work that's been happening at the Michigan Office for New Americans for a number of years now, and are just extremely impressed with the way that she has managed to pull a lot of these issues related to foreign trained professionals and the barriers they face into some new programmatic elements that their office have been able to sponsor. So Karen, delighted to have you join us and eager to hear a more detailed description of some of the efforts you've been involved in.
Thanks a lot, Margie. It's great to be here. First, just a brief overview of the Michigan Office for New Americans. We were created by Governor Snyder via executive order in January of 2014, and our mission is to help grow Michigan's economy by attracting and retaining global talent, promoting the skills, energy, and entrepreneurial spirit of our immigrant communities, and just generally making Michigan a more welcoming state overall. Excuse me. Specifically, we support immigration initiatives for the state of Michigan. We coordinate with state agencies that provide programs related to services for immigrants. They might not be programs that are directly for immigrants, but they might be programs that immigrants are able to take advantage of. And we look for barriers and try and reduce or minimize those barriers while maintaining the integrity of whatever that program might be. We analyze and make recommendations to the governor on state and federal policy and programs as it relates to immigration. We lead two different efforts. One's called Global Michigan, which is a statewide group of universities, nonprofits, economic development organizations, some of our state ethnic, our three state ethnic commissions, and some of the state agencies. That meets three times a year and looks at immigrant integration in Michigan overall, how we retain and attract international and entrepreneurial talent to our state. We also convene what's called our ethnic cabinet, which is about 50 to 60 different ethnic chambers, ethnic business organizations, and our three state ethnic commissions. That group meets quarterly and really is an exchange of information between the state of Michigan and those various ethnic groups. And then finally, as I mentioned, we strive every day to make Michigan a more welcoming environment for immigrants. And when looking at the focus of the report, you know, Michigan has a number of initiatives that we've been working on to try and reduce barriers for foreign-trained immigrants, individuals who might be foreign-born, who are foreign-educated and foreign-trained. And first, we have our Michigan International Talent Solutions Program, or the MITS program. MITS was launched in October of 2015. It's a partnership with Upwardly Global. I know Upwardly Global is also mentioned in the report a number of times. They've been a good partner of ours ever since our office started. And what the MITS program does is it works with individuals who are permanently work authorized, who are either unemployed or underemployed, and gets them into jobs that better fit their skill set. These are individuals who have a bachelor's or higher degree, and for most of the Michigan job seekers, it's actually master's or higher. They do have to be proficient in English, and there's a number of other kind of components they have to comply with in order to be accepted into this program, but essentially it's a two-way partnership where we utilize Upwardly Global's onboarding process, their online onboarding process, to get the job seeker a little bit more job ready, and then our program director here for the MITS program in Michigan connects job seekers and employers that are seeking talent to help actually, you know, place those job seekers in jobs. It's a very niche type program, but it's been working out really well so far. The average annual salary increase for the individuals is greater than $40,000. It's actually closer to $44,000, which for immigrants is, you know, that are here, that's pretty life changing. And so far, the program has over a 90% retention rate after 1 year of hire. And for our job seekers and employers, one of the largest benefits is the fact that there's no cost to them. This is a fully funded state, fully state-funded program. We have also, through our work with the MITS program, as well as some other, strategy groups that we've convened over the last year and a half here in the state of Michigan with regard to immigrants and refugees, we've seen a great need for adult ESL funding. And so, we just in December, a couple months ago, MONA granted its first ever, awarded its first ever grants for adult ESL. The main requirement for these grants was that the programs be innovative and creative, and we also required collaboration. So a single entity could not apply on their own. There had to have been multiple entities working together to provide services. And we received a number of applications, and the panel review group that awarded the grants, awarded them to a range of programs that included such things as programs for vocational English as a second language, TOEFL track programs, as well as English and skills to employment programs. And then we had two contextualized ESL programs that were granted some funding. We don't have any metrics yet on those because they literally just launched. Their first reports are due to us in the next month. But our hope is that we see some, if we get some good metrics back, we're hoping to get some additional state funding to issue more grants going forward. And then we also are literally still in the process of negotiating another partnership with Upwardly Global, as well as Education First, to provide degreed individuals who are in our MITS program with additional English language skills to help enter their field. So if individuals are pretty much job ready with the exception of needing some additional English language ability, we'll be working in partnership with Upwardly Global and Education First to get those individuals job ready from an English perspective. So we're really excited about that opportunity, and again, just continuing to grow our partnership with Upwardly Global. one of the things that Michigan has really been known for is the work we've done with regard to skilled immigrant licensing guides. And this is another way that we strive to reduce barriers to foreign-born who are foreign-educated and foreign-trained. We've worked very closely with our Department of Licensing and Regulatory Affairs. And I guess I should note for those on the phone, from what I understand, Michigan seems to be fairly unique in that almost all of our occupational licensing is done through LARA, the Department of Licensing and Regulatory Affairs. It's not where we don't have different state departments doing licensing, and almost everything's done through LARA. And this started out, our skilled immigrant licensing guide work started out, again, partnership with Upwardly Global. Upwardly Global has devised skilled immigrant licensing guides. They have, I believe, 10 or 11 professional guides that they developed. We worked in partnership with them a little over 3 years ago, almost 3.5 years ago now, to have those initial 11 licensing guides created for the state of Michigan. But we liked the format of those guides so much and felt the need, based on a lot of demand through our ethnic cabinet specifically, to expand on the licensing guides. So we got permission from Upwardly Global to use their template, but now we have over 44 different licensing guides, and they range, as you can see, everything from accountant to architect to barber, electrician, medical doctor, physical therapist, teacher, social worker, therapists, landscape architects, dentist. We've a wide range of licensing guides. And what these guides do is it takes the licensing process in the state of Michigan and breaks it down in a step-by-step process for individuals who are foreign educated and foreign trained. And it talks about, you know, do I need to have my credentials evaluated and how do I do that? Do I need to take any type of tests and how do I do that? And really breaks it down, as I mentioned, step by step. In addition to the licensing guides, we also understand and appreciate that navigating state government can be challenging. So we developed one dedicated phone number for individuals to call for licensing assistance. So regardless of what type of license you're applying for, there's one phone number that you can call. That individual may or may not have all of the answers, but even if they don't have all of the answers, they definitely can connect individuals with someone who can answer their questions. So individuals aren't having to spend time navigating, you know, state government on their own. And then out of this licensing work and through our ethnic cabinet, we discovered a need for individuals who have barriers that are primarily due to them coming from countries of conflict. And so we worked with our legislature in June of 2014 to pass what we call the Barber Bill. This was identified through our Chaldean community. If you're aware of Michigan and its composition of immigrants, we have a very large Chaldean Christian Iraqi population here in Michigan. And I didn't know this at the time, but I've learned through our work with the Chaldean community that being a barber is actually a very prestigious profession in Iraq. And so we had a number of individuals here who were barbers, but they were unable to be licensed. And because they would have had to gone through the entire, redo all of their training in order to become licensed as a barber here in the state of Michigan. And I believe that was something like over 1,300 hours of hands-on time that they needed to become licensed. So what we did, again, with our quote-unquote barber bill was allow our LARA licensing board to deem someone as coming from a country of conflict, and this is specifically in this barber profession, and then those individuals can provide secondary types of evidence, self-attestations, et cetera, to be able to reduce the number of hours that they need to be licensed as a barber. I believe they can end up reducing it to all but maybe 100 or so hours, and those are more some of the OSHA laws and things that individuals have to go through for health and safety purposes. And what we're looking to do, this is kind of a test case for us in terms of the barber bill, we're looking to expand that idea of individuals coming from a country of conflict and not having access to documents. We're looking to expand that concept into other occupations as well. Again, just going along with that whole theme of trying to minimize or reduce barriers to individuals. And I would say in terms of the work that we have done, what really is important, we feel, is having champions in different areas in terms of the work that we do specifically within state government. So we obviously have champions within our Department of Licensing and Regulatory Affairs, our Workforce Development Agency, within the Governor's Office, and finding those individuals has really helped us be able to create these initiatives and move these initiatives forward. And with that, I will turn the presentation back to Margie for the question and answer period.
Thank you so much, Karen. That was That's a lot of information to get into a short amount of time, and so impressive all the work that you all have been able to accomplish out there. So, so folks, please keep sending in your questions via the Q&A chat, the Q&A function, or through the chat function. Thanks for those that we've already gotten. And I think, Madeline, I'll just send one of the earlier questions that came into you that asked about could we give some examples of employer partnerships, sort of, you know, who set them up, what do they do? So why don't we start there?
Sure. So one example of a great employer partnership is Upwardly Global's work with the company Accenture. They have had a pretty long-standing partnership where Accenture employees can volunteer with Upwardly Global to help with mock interviews and networking events. And then Accenture has actually hired some Upwardly Global clients through their work. Another example, kind of a different model, would be the Suburban Maryland Welcome Back Center and their partnership with some local hospitals to set up the nurse in training positions that allow foreign trained nurses to get the hands-on training. In terms of who sets those up, it's generally just staff from the organizations, I think, reaching out to employers and describing what they do and talking about how such a partnership would work. And another thing that we've heard is volunteering is a great way to help build ties, starting with a couple individuals maybe who are really passionate, and then they can bring back that experience to the rest of their organization and possibly expand from there.
Great, thanks. And then we've also gotten a few questions related to some of the developments around addressing issues of similar issues that veterans and military spouses face. So I'll just say that that for those of you who are asking about the report that was issued around that, you can, if you just look in the report that we published, we reference it on page 24. And I'm pretty sure, Madeline, I'm not sure if it's in the works cited, is it that it was published by the Department of Defense, but we can, the U.S. Department of Defense, but we can get back to you with that?
Yeah, sure. We can answer via email. I believe the report was actually published by the Executive Office of the President,
right.
But it was a follow-on to a Department of Defense initiative.
Right. And so then there's another piece that we didn't actually present in this webinar on, but that really might be of interest to all of you, that, you know, so over a 2 or 3 year period, what was happening at the White House level, starting first, I guess, with the Department of Defense Task Force around veteran and family issues, then and then that making it over into this White House initiative. Department of Labor got involved then in creating, I guess you'd call it, in a sense, technical assistance money, trying to bring a number of states and other actors together to look at their licensing system. So we talk a little bit about that as well. Madeline, you wanted to say a word or two about that?
Yeah, so it was a $7.5 million dollar grant opportunity that the Department of Labor put out. And they awarded the grant to the National Conference of State Legislatures in partnership with the National Governors Association. And that grant is intended for states to look at the licensing regulations and how they might be streamlined. It doesn't focus specifically on immigrants, but the hope is that that may be a component of the study.
Great. Okay, and then Karen, I'm just going to combine a few of the questions that came through for you that are in kind of the same area. So one question I guess is a little more about, you know, who does MIS actually work with? For example, is it possible for international students who received a bachelor's degree from a U.S. university and are on an F-1 student visa to access those services? And then also, how does MIS handle initial degree evaluation for people? Can you just say more about that, because that's a topic of interest?
Sure. For international students, it would not apply. MITS would not apply. MITS is a very niche program. It's for those who are permanently work authorized. So it does work with individuals who have green cards. It does work with actually with asylees. So you have to have, it could be someone who is married to a U.S. citizen. It could be someone who is spouse of an employment-based visa process that has a green card. It could be diversity visa lottery winners. Anyone who would meet the category of being permanently work authorized. So that's one of the caveats for the program. In terms of the credentialing, in the state licensing guides, it talks about who would need credentialing and how that works. And we've worked closely with WES, World Education Services, on the credentialing piece. The state doesn't necessarily provide the funding for credentialing. Individuals would have to do that on their own.
Great. And then we also have, could you say maybe a little bit, Karen, about all the things that are up on your website? Because I think folks are just curious about how much can they find there versus...
Sure,
you know,
sure. So there would be potentially two websites. You can go to www.michigan.gov/MONA, M-O-N-A. And that has got a whole range of information, including the access to the licensing guides and information about the MITS program, any of our newsletters we put out. You know, all that information can be found. Our different resources can all be found on our website. Or if you're interested specifically in the MITS program, michigan.gov/MITS, M-I-T-S, also would take you directly to the MITS website.
Perfect. Okay, so Madeline, there's a question here about programs that specifically focus on nurses, and did we look at any of them? So do you want to talk a bit about that?
Sure. So nursing is actually one of the professions that has maybe the most resources in terms of qualification recognition. I would advise you to look up the Welcome Back Initiative and see if they have a center in your state. We highlighted a few of them in the report, but there's actually many others, including in New York and Boston, I believe. And then we also looked at the Chicago Bilingual Nurse Consortium, which has a number of resources, especially great English resources for foreign trained nurses.
Great. And then Karen, I was thinking as you were speaking, and then there's a question that's come in about this as well. So could you say a little more about how Michigan came to be as sensitive, I guess I would say, as it is, to needs for foreign-trained individuals? Like, how much of it is studying the demand side of professions and, you know, kind of like intellectual convincing people, you know, that that you've got these folks who can't use your degrees at the same, their degrees at the same time that you have shortages in some of these key occupations in the state, you know, or how much of it is because of the ethnic council that you have set up and the feedback that you're getting from communities? You know, what are some of the things that kind of tip the balance for the state to be more proactive on these issues?
So really, for us, it starts at the top. Governor Snyder, prior to being governor, when he was private citizen, Rick Snyder was always very interested in immigration, and in particular, looking at retaining international talent coming out of the University of Michigan. At the time, he ran an economic development group called Ann Arbor Spark, and that has carried, and he's also has been very interested in the any type of employment-based immigrant investors type visas, and that just has to do with some of his background. So he carried that with him when he got elected, and so that's really where it started. In particular, for international talent, the governor is very vocal about, in particular with international students, about how he, you know, thinks it's fairly pointless about the fact that we are educating these bright individuals for the future, and then we send them home. So he has constantly tried to strive to look for ways to work within the immigration system to, again, attract and retain international and entrepreneurial talent to our state. So it started there, and then obviously once our office was officially created in January of 2014, it's just increased from there. And as I mentioned before about those champions, you know, we've got great partners in our Department of Licensing and Regulatory Affairs and in our Talent and Investment Agency, and specifically the Workforce Development Director within our Department of Health and Human Services and the Governor's Office. You know, we've got a lot of support from those different departments to do the work that we do, and working with those departments over the years has really helped them kind of take a better look at the constituents that they serve and how to better serve those populations.
Excellent. All right, so several of you are clearly don't have licensing guides for your state, so that's obviously an issue that that I think it's a great thing to point out that that maybe your states need them. Some of the questions are saying, for example, are the Michigan guides going to mainly be useful only for Michigan? And so it often is the case that the licensing guides are not easily used for folks in other states. Not that they have no use, but that they really do need to be tailored usually to states. And that's why, for example, there's a great set that's put out by Welcoming Center for New Pennsylvanians that deals with Pennsylvania, than the ones that Karen was just speaking about for Michigan. And so a number of states have them. So for those of you who are writing in, maybe just let us know what state you're from, and we'll let you know if we know of any that are available there. A number of you have also been asking about how can faith-based leaders or communities be more helpful in having foreign-trained professionals be integrated into the workforce. And Karen, I'll pass that to you in a second in case you have any thoughts on that. But I would say that many of the large refugee resettlement networks are faith-based and or are associated with major religions. I would say that Lutheran Immigrant and Refugee Services did some very groundbreaking work in this area in recent years, trying to build capacity of different resettlement of their various resettlement agencies in this area, and then shared some of the work that they did. They have a number of resources that may still be available online. So I'll write back to those of you who wrote in with those sorts of questions. So it may be that that you're even part of a faith-based refugee resettlement network that may have its own resources around these issues. But then I would say also that more broadly, sort of not in terms of doing very specific gap-filling programs, for example, for foreign-trained professionals. I think another thing that we've seen in faith-based groups, and we're talking about it in another report that will be part of this series. We have a report that focuses just specifically on kind of forward-leaning refugee resettlement practices. And one of the things that we found there was an initiative undertaken by Catholic Charities in a number of states, where they brought together, they set up volunteer networks of professionals in different parishes that would volunteer specifically to coach and work with refugees around their integration into the workforce. It was a way of building their social capital and helping them link them, first of all, to folks helping them with navigating their job search and the like, preparing for interviews, but then also actually having the volunteers use their personal contacts to help people get interviews for jobs and the like. So, I think there are a lot of different opportunities out there for faith-based groups to be helpful in this area that that are short of setting up actual bridge-type programs. But not that some aren't also doing that. Karen, do you want to add anything to that?
Sure. Just to quickly echo what Margie just said, I mean, for us, in terms of our adult ESL funding, that actually came out of a refugee work group that we held in 2015, and that included Jewish Family Services, Samaritas, which is formerly known as Lutheran Social Services here in Michigan, as well as Catholic Charities and Bethany Christian Services. You know, so there were some obviously faith-based our refugee service organizations that were working with us on our refugee strategy group that really, again, really highlighted even more than we already knew the fact that adult ESL funding was critical. in terms of specifically what can other potentially maybe churches or other faith-based groups help out with, again, to kind of echo what Margie said, you might be able to put together a professional network of individuals within those faith-based communities who could serve as professional connectors to arriving immigrants or refugees who may not have their own professional network, and maybe these people can meet with them and talk with them and introduce them to other people that they know within their own network to try and expand professional networks for individuals. And then finally, potentially partnering with an ESL class to do ESL chat sessions, right? For one of the best ways to try and learn English is to be able to speak it in a comfortable and kind of safe environment. So maybe trying to see if they'll host an ESL chat session with some of their community members.
Excellent, excellent ideas. So we're pretty much at time, so I just want to quickly respond to one of the questions that asked about studies of the demand side of needs for professionals for filling gaps in health professions. I would say that that we're aware of a study that the Massachusetts Immigrant and Refugee Advocacy Coalition was part of. It should be up on their website, but it was one of the pieces of work that set in motion the governor's task force there, looking at the healthcare professions. And so for the person who wrote in about that, just let us know if you can't find it, and we'll be happy to get a copy of that to you. And then I know that, so MPM, our center here partnered with a few state-level organizations. It was Massachusetts, Illinois, and Washington State, for a 1 or 2 year period, trying to help them look at where their big gaps were in terms of their underemployed foreign trained professionals, and then trying to help them think about solutions for addressing that. So I believe that as part of that, there's also a demand side report out of One America that, in Washington State, that looks at needs in the education profession. And, you know, that is another area that that we do think that the field can expand into, because what we're hearing from a lot of community colleges is that that they're encountering a lot of folks who have education degrees from their home country and who haven't been able to figure out how to make their way through licensing systems here. But anyway, let me, we do need to wrap, and so I'll just say for those of you whose questions we didn't get to, we're really interested. If two of you wrote in asking about folks who came in on special immigrant visas through refugee resettlement agencies and had worked with our military, and are there specific programs that are helpful to them. So we'll definitely look into that and try and give you a referrals around that, and then we just saw that some other questions came in on the events email, so we'll get back to all of you who wrote, but in the meantime, just thank you so much for joining us. Karen, thank you so much for all the great information you shared, and here are all of our emails, so please feel free to use any of these emails to follow up on any questions you didn't think to ask today, and otherwise we'll be getting back to those of you whose questions we didn't get to. Okay, thanks again for joining us, and best of luck with trying to move forward. Bye-bye.